Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Altum Transport against Westchester Fire Insurance Company. Mr. Zott.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Eric Emerson.
Oh, sorry.
I represent Altum Transport Company. Thank you. Your Honors, this is an insurance coverage dispute, yet another insurance coverage dispute regarding the duty to defend.
Would you raise that a tad? No.
They can help you. There's a
button,
so it'll go up higher.
She'll get it for you.
There you go.
See, the wonders of modern civilization.
You know, it's a good thing I didn't use the stool down here.
So, Mr. Emerson, would you mind beginning with a comment or two about diversity jurisdiction, because this is something that we're still interested in.
Sure. Your Honor, we as the insured, filed this case, declaratory judgment action, in Cook County Circuit Court. We named as party defendants Westchester as the insurance company. We also named Michael Stampley, who is the claimant in the underlying case. We thought that was
so why was he adverse to you there? You would think Mr. Stampley would like the idea of money being around to pay his claim.
That's exactly right. He was not adverse, but he did have to be named as a party to the lawsuit because he clearly has an interest in the proceeds of the Westchester policy.
And so the question, though, is if he belongs on the defendant's side, then we have a real problem with diversity jurisdiction.
You do, Your Honor. And there was a notice of removal that was filed by Westchester to this court. There was case law cited.
The Northern District, yes.
There was case law that was cited in the notice of removal that supported, arguably, a realignment of the parties or, for purposes of the insurance coverage dispute, to disregard Mr. Stampley for purposes of subject matter jurisdiction based upon diversity.
Now, do you think this court, meaning the Seventh Circuit, not the Northern District, would have the authority simply to dismiss Mr. Stampley from the case, for example? I mean, whatever Cook County wants in the way of parties isn't binding on the federal court, is it?
It is not. It is not, Your Honor. I think it's if the question that is posed to me this morning is similar to the question that was posed before we got into briefing on the merits, this case caption does not support a finding of diversity jurisdiction. There would need to be a realignment, or Mr. Stampley would have to be disregarded for purposes of establishing diversity jurisdiction. Otherwise, we've got a Illinois trucking company.
Right.
So I completely agree.
Right. Now, that's Civ Pro 101. We all know that. So the question I guess I'm asking is, who is responsible for realigning? Is that something that happens at the Court of Appeals? And just to put a case on it, you know, is a case something like the Supreme Court's Newman Green decision, which allows for correction of diversity problems, even at the Court of Appeals level, the sort of thing, I mean, you say disregarded, and I'm not sure what that means. You know, maybe disregarded means we dismiss him from the case altogether and say you're not in it, or maybe, you know, I don't know how you just sort of say we're not going to pay attention to you.
Right. I think there needs to be a recognition or an assumption made that the parties, both the named insured Altum and Mr. Stampley, for purposes of the insurance coverage dispute, would have to be treated as being on one side of this case because their interests are antagonistic with that of Westchester's insurance company.
Okay.
And I do think my suggestion, Your Honor, is I certainly appreciate the fact that this court needs to satisfy itself as regard to jurisdiction, and the court below would have needed to go through an analysis. But we never got to that point. The decision was made not to file a motion to remand because there was case law that was cited in the notice of removal. So the strategic decision and actually an economic decision was made. Why join the fight on the jurisdictional issue where it at least appeared that there were grounds to realign the parties, to have the insurance coverage dispute ruled upon on the merits? So that's why our answer has really been two answers. Does the case caption as it now exists support diversity jurisdiction? The answer is no. Is it possible for this court or the district court to realign the parties in order to get to the merits of the to the insurance dispute? I suggest yes.
Okay, so what about these merits? You know, I'm looking on your brief at page 10, where this unpaid wages or other compensation language appears in this exclusion. It doesn't say this is just compensation paid to employees, so why wasn't the district court reading this quite reasonably?
Mr. Stampley, it's undisputed, is an owner-operator. He owns his own truck, he provides his own services, and
no,
Altom actually leases him.
But he's getting money. I mean, you know, compensation means, you know, you're paid for what you do. And we pay independent contractors, and we pay employees. There are other tax consequences, other things that are different, but why isn't this unpaid wages or other compensation a broad enough phrase to bring in the kind of funds, if you will, the kind of money that Mr. Stampley got for his services?
It's a great question, Your Honor, and I'm not sure how broad it gets read. I think you have to look to the second part of that exclusion that talks about employment-related matter, employment claims and employment-related matters as qualifying that which precedes it, which to me includes all the trappings of employment, wages, payroll deductions, things related to businesses retaining, hiring, and paying their employees. As a matter of fact, there's another coverage form in that policy that's called employment practices coverage. So to the extent that there is a confusion that exists about what that exclusion really means in this context, I don't believe that Westchester has come before the district court or has established in its briefs that exclusion is properly applied to the allegations as they exist in this claim.
So what's your response to the argument that Westchester makes that there be no conceivable reason to make Westchester a surety for the payment of compensation to independent contractors, that there would be a giant moral hazard created if we were to read the policy your way?
I think that would require you to make an assumption that there is a finding of fact in the court below that they actually did something wrong. The Kruger case, which is cited by Westchester and addressed by us, was an indemnity case. There, the court decided that there should be no indemnity because there had been a prior finding of improper, wrongful behavior.
But at a broader level, writing insurance policies is something, I mean, they cover all sorts of behavior, and most rational economic actors don't want to find out the answer midway through litigation. Litigation's expensive, so they try to write the policies. And why wouldn't they have wanted to exclude the kind of compensation that they pay to independent contractors?
Your Honor, I don't view it as being compensation. I mean, there's multiple counts. There are three counts in this complaint. Only one it deals with whether he was paid properly under the compensation
Well, he charges them for his services, doesn't he?
He does, but there are multiple counts.
He gets this 70% cut, right? Why isn't that compensation?
Well, because he's claiming a 70% cut of what is a reimbursable expense to Altom.
But he also gets, I mean, he's been paid all these others, the 70% cut of all the things he's hauled for them over the years. This is just extra, but I'm just saying he gets compensated for his services, and you know, you want, I guess, to use a different word for it, but I'm not sure what word that would be.
Well, to the extent that he is claiming that he's not paid under his lease what he is owed, then that would be a breach of contract claim. That is separate from count one of the complaint, which is a regulatory violation claim, where he is saying that the face of the lease, which has no requirement of compensation, the regulatory requirements under 376.12 only requires that the compensation be stated on the face of the lease. It does not have any requirements as to how you calculate that compensation. And in fact, it has its own damage component, which is in the United States Code under 14704. It doesn't say what those damages are.
But doesn't there have to be a lease before any of this gets triggered? I think that's what your opponents argue, that you have these three theories. I understand that, the regulatory theory, the breach of the lease theory, and the unjust enrichment theory. Unjust enrichment, I think you're in real trouble with, because when there's a written contract, Illinois doesn't turn to unjust enrichment. But let's look at the regulatory one. That only gets triggered if there's a contract. Isn't that a kind of a condition precedent?
The regulation is triggered that requires the motor carriers to have an agreement. If the agreement is not in place, then the liability is clearly triggered.
But here we have an agreement, right? And you're complaining that he's not getting compensated pursuant to the terms of the agreement, the 70% for these cleaning fees.
On the cleaning fees, that's correct. But that is separate from the allegations that he is making and the relief that he's seeking.
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
Well, let me ask this, though, about the truth in lending count. What factual allegations were in that count of his complaint that did not directly relate to the allegations that Altum didn't follow the terms of his contract with the owner-operators?
That the lease was unclear, Your Honor. The regulations under 376.12 requires that the compensation rate be listed clearly in the lease. And his contention, I believe, based upon a generous reading of the allegations of the complaint, are that that lease on its face was in violation of the regulations, which has its own damage component. I'm not sure how he is going to arrive at those damages, but that is a regulatory violation. There is nothing related to how that compensation is actually computed. But the regulation is there to ensure there's an arm's length transaction between the motor carrier and the independent contractor that at least has some rate of pay. And all that's required under the lease is that it's a percentage either of gross or based on the mileage. And there are a whole laundry list of requirements that have to be in that lease, only one of which is compensation. So the position that he's taken in count one is that that lease is in violation of that statute, and the damages are based upon the enabling statute, not breach of contract. Now, yes, is he going to argue that there's some failure to pay this amount of money and that's the amount of damages? That's true. However, it is for purposes of the duty to defend based upon the allegations of the underlying claim, and to the extent that Westchester has relied on these two exclusions, which are confusing and vague and subject to argument amongst us here, I think the benefits should be, all the benefits should be weighed in favor of the policyholder in this case and against the insurance company. I just don't think that has been established here that these exclusions apply to these allegations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. Mr. Wadley.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Wadley, and I represent Westchester Fire Insurance Company. Your Honors, Westchester did not agree in the policy that it sold to Altum to indemnify Altum for Altum's responsibility to compensate the drivers it hired to transport goods on its behalf.
So here's my issue with that point. I have no trouble following your argument that Westchester wouldn't have wanted to do that, but insurance law is law based on written agreements, and sometimes people decide they need to change their agreements. And when I look at this capital C1M language, which is reproduced here and there through the papers, the context of that M really seems to me to deal with employment. Everything except for that other, well, unpaid wages or other compensation, that could be a bonus, that could be vacation time, it could be all sorts of things. It doesn't have to stretch all the way out to every invoice that you pay to somebody who's performed services, whether it's to your cleaning service or whether it's to, you know, anybody else. And then you get to subpart two, any other employment or employment-related matters. Well, why would you use the word other if subparagraph little one didn't also mean employment. So it's a contextual reading that I'm struggling with here.
Well, Your Honor, there certainly are elements of this that deal with employment-related matters, and hence in the second subparagraph it says other employment or employment-related matters. But
well, with reference to the first paragraph, that's my issue. The first paragraph begins improper payroll deductions. Well, that's certainly an employee. Unpaid wages, that's an employee. And then we have or other compensation, and in context, does that other compensation really mean other things you might be paying an employee? Employees get things other than wages. They might get commissions. They might get, you know, as I said, bonuses. Could mean something.
I, respectfully, Your Honor, we don't believe that's a reasonable interpretation of an insurance policy. We have to look at the purpose and scope of insurance policies when we interpret them. That's what Illinois law says.
Absolutely. And you've even singled out one form of independent contract in subpart 2, independently contracted employees, which maybe means, you know, temporary work agencies or something. But I'm fighting off the thought that you're asking us to write into the policy a new paragraph that deals with the insured's use of independent contractors.
And to the contrary, Your Honor, I think that the insured and the claimant in this case are trying to write in a limitation to the unpaid wages or other compensation phrase to say unpaid wages or other compensation paid to employees, which is not there. And the distinction that they're making is that, well, because the owner-operators were technically independent contractors rather than employees, the exclusion doesn't apply because the exclusion only applies to employees. There's no limitation that says it only applies to employees. And in fact,
unless you get it from context. I mean, we do have to read contracts, Illinois Supreme Court tells us, as a whole.
Right? True, but even then, some of these things don't necessarily apply just to employees. Misclassification of employee status could be misclassifying an employee as an independent contractor and vice versa. The subparagraph 2, where we talk about the other employment or employment-related matters, applies not just to employees, but applicants for employment, as well as any of the directors and officers, which includes but is not limited to employees. And then it goes on to say voluntary, seasonal, temporary, leased, or independently contracted employee of the company. So I think the intent of this exclusion is to broadly say, look, we're not going to reimburse you. We're not going to indemnify the insured for what it has to compensate, what it has to pay those it hires to perform work on its behalf. And that's consistent with the nature and purpose of insurance policies.
It just seems like a very awkward way to do it, and then we run up against the principle also followed by the Illinois Supreme Court that if there's ambiguity, you construe it in favor of the insured, not the insurer.
That's true, but I think we need to be careful to distinguish breadth and ambiguity. It's a broad exclusion. There's no question about it, but that doesn't mean that it's ambiguous.
No, I understand the difference between breadth and ambiguity, but I'm struck by something that talks about nothing but employment except when you come to this word other compensation tucked between wages and misclassification of employee status. You know, and why that's not at least an ambiguous term, I don't think it's clear, to be honest.
Your Honor, it's not ambiguous because it would be unreasonable to construe an insurance policy to cover an insured's obligation to compensate independent contractors. And this court touched upon those issues in the Kruger case, where Judge Posner gave an example. Suppose you hire a contractor to build an extension on your house, and after he has completed the work, you refuse to pay him, and when he sues, you turn his claim over to the insurance company.
No, I'm totally sympathetic with your idea that insurance companies at least want to know if they're being asked to write a surety as opposed to just an insurance policy. It's not that you couldn't have them in the market, but pricing and the rest follows that. But the question in each case is what policy did you write, and that we have to follow.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, you have to, a policy is ambiguous only if it's capable of more than one reasonable interpretation. And we don't believe it's reasonable to interpret this exclusion as not applying to amounts that the insured has agreed to compensate its owner-operators, its truck drivers. And that's what the underlying case is all about. Contrary to what counsel said about, well, there's different counts, right in the first paragraph, the nature of the class action, the allegation is Altum engaged in an unlawful course of conduct by knowingly and unlawfully reducing and intentionally miscalculating plaintiff's compensation and the compensation of other members of the class. Throughout the complaint, there's complaints that they're being undercompensated because they're not getting 70% of the gross amount received, which is what they...
For these cleaning fees. Yeah, I mean, actually, the underlying case baffles me, but putting that to one side, I guess I am less taken with the contract argument since I gather, in this court at least, they've conceded that the measure of damages on the regulatory claim might not be this 70% number. It might be some regulatory number.
I don't know that that's been conceded. That was counsel for Altum that was arguing, not counsel for the claim. If you look at the complaint, if you look at the underlying complaint, Stampley's complaint in count one, which is the regulatory count, the last paragraph states, as a direct and proximate result of the violations of 49 CFR 376.12 committed by Altum, owner-operators, including plaintiff and the members of the class, were injured and are entitled to recover the difference between 70% of gross minus 70% of the lesser amount that was used to calculate owner-operator compensation. So they're seeking the benefit of their bargain under all three of their causes of action, which leads into the second exclusion that applies here, Your Honor, which is the breach of contract exclusion. And
so your position is you're okay if either one of them holds.
We believe that either one knocks out all three causes of action here.
Okay.
And so I'll turn now to the breach of contract exclusion, which excludes all claims that arise out of a breach of contract. And that doesn't mean that just because one count isn't labeled breach of contract that it doesn't apply. What it means is that if the claim wouldn't exist but for the failure to comply with the agreement, then the exclusion knocks it out. Because again, it's this whole moral hazard thing that insurance companies don't compensate you for not living up to promises that you give to your workers or your customers or this, that, or the other thing. And so... all three of these causes of action would not exist but for the breach of the contract. In fact, one point that's perhaps not emphasized enough in the briefs is, you know, they make the argument that, well, the regulatory claim might exist even without a lease agreement because it requires a lease agreement, and if you don't have a lease agreement, then you violated the regulation.
And there appears to be a cause of action created by the regulation.
Correct, but that's a red herring because there's no allegation here that there's no agreement between the owner-operators and Altum. In fact, if you look at the class that's both identified in the complaint as well as what was certified by the district court, the class only includes owner-operators that had entered into contracts with Altum. So we're not talking about people that didn't have contracts. We're not talking about people where there wasn't an alleged breach of the contract.
Is there any allegation that all of these contracts for the unnamed members of the class have that same 70% number?
I believe that the...
It would be odd, it seems to me.
I don't recall exactly what the certified class is, but I think it is. I think that's the standard of what they agreed to pay their owner-operators, and it looks like the narrow issue below is whether the gross amount should have included these tank washing fees or not. So in any event, you know, we believe that the breach of contract exclusion applies to all three because they're all three causes of action are dependent upon Altum failing to pay the agreed upon 70% compensation. So, whichever exclusion applies, we think all three are knocked out district court's decision ought to be affirmed on that basis. I'll touch briefly on jurisdiction because Your Honor raised it. The way the case is captioned is not the final say on whether jurisdiction exists. This court has been clear that you look at the interests of the parties, and where there's not true adversity, the parties ought to be realigned. And in fact,
did you find any cases where the Court of Appeals on its own has realigned, or does one remand to the district court to do that?
I didn't find any where this court realigned. But one of the things that Your Honor raised is the possibility of simply dismissing Mr. Stampley from the suit, and that's exactly what happened in R.C. Wegman Construction versus Admiral Insurance Company. That was a case where the insured sued the insurance company. That was a bad faith case. Nevertheless, the insured named the underlying claimant, who obviously had an interest in securing money from the insurance company. In that case, I believe it was Judge Posner said, not an essential party to this action. We can dismiss him. He was dismissed. And Judge Posner went on to say, you know, he probably has a stake here, which would allow him to intervene. But if he were to intervene, it would be on the plaintiff's side rather than the defendant's side. So we don't have a diversity issue. So that's certainly an option that the court can take here. I think the court, as you indicated, because it can remedy jurisdictional issues, I think the court could realign the parties on appeal, but I just don't have a case site for you on that point. And so I guess the last point is that another argument that was made in the briefs is that the district court's decision was somehow premature because it was on a Rule 12b-6. It wasn't premature. The duty to defend is determined by comparing the allegations of the underlying complaint to the policy. Both of those were attached to the instant complaint. That was all the district court needed to determine whether these exclusions applied to defeat coverage. So unless the panel has any more questions, I'll see the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Zell, I believe you had some rebuttal time.
Just 1 minute. Good morning. My name is Andrew Zott, and I represent Michael Stampley, the underlying claimant in the action. And I'd just like to briefly address two comments you made while Mr. Emerson was up at the podium. One was this question about a moral hazard. And is there a moral hazard if, or isn't there a moral hazard if insurance companies are forced to insure, you know, some contractual obligation, such as between an independent contractor and a developer? Maybe, but this is not the case. This is primarily a regulatory action, and this insurance policy is a D&O coverage policy. And they are essentially ensuring that to the extent that there is any sort of regulatory violation, there is coverage. Now, with respect to the question of whether or not Mr. Stampley's regulatory claim is entirely dependent upon the existence of a contract, I would submit that the answer is no.
So, does that mean that you are not wedded to this 70% figure? Because Mr. Wadley read language from the complaint that makes it look like it's just a breach of contract or breach of lease agreement complaint dressed up under the regulations.
Well, that is what we allege in our complaint, certainly. But you know, anything can happen in litigation, and there's a case out of the 11th.
So are you conceding that maybe you're not entitled to the 70% that was in the contract?
No, I'm not conceding that. No, but what I'm saying is that, you know, there's an 11th Circuit case out there that basically says that if an owner operator is somehow aware of the reductions to his compensation, that and they take on additional shipments, that therefore they can't, you know, pursuant to detrimental reliance, which there's case law here in the Seventh Circuit that says detrimental reliance doesn't apply, but if detrimental reliance applies, you can't rely upon the the okay, contractual
you need,
provisions.
You need to conclude at this point.
But there's damage nonetheless. Independent contractors in the trucking industry spend a significant amount of capital signing up with a trucking industry.
Yeah. Okay,
with a carrier.
All right, and Mr. Emerson, you did run out of time, so we will take this case under advisement, and the court will take a brief recess.